Okay, well, I think everybody, all three commissioners, all of us are on the call. So I'm going to bring this meeting to order on February 6th of 2024. We all got our packets on Friday. Thank you, Twee. And the first item is approving the minutes from January 16th. I move to approve the minutes. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. It's been moved and seconded. So all those in favor, any debate, any friendly amendments? See none. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye. Aye, Sarah.
Aye, Josh.
Aye, John.
The minutes are approved. Moving on to our loan portfolio today, we have a lot of loans. There are 9 loans at a little over $13.5 million. Is there a motion to approve the loans?
I so move.
I will second it. And then, Rich, I'm going to turn it over to you to walk us through the loans for today.
Thanks, Sarah. We have some bread and butter loans, as I like to say, at the beginning of the page. We move down to number 4 for the Menasha School District. They had a referendum in 2022 for about $100 million debt issuance to finance school construction. And then they issued bonds for about $90 million. And this loan is to finish up those projects. On a side note, we have received the library aid distributions for each of the school districts for 2024. It's been split up into all 420 plus school districts, and the Menasha School District is set to receive $247,000 this year.
Great.
Moving down to loan number 5. This loan, you know, the Village of Somerset issued a short-term note to acquire land for their tax incremental district number 5. Following that, they decided they wanted a much longer time period to pay off that debt. And so they're refinancing that initial note with a longer-term loan from us. Number 7, 8, and 9 are from the City of St. Croix Falls. Number 7 is a fairly large loan for sewer project. We expect this to be paid off. It's an interim loan, and we expect this loan to be paid off in a few months with a Safe Drinking Water Fund loan issued by the Department of Administration with a subsidized interest rate. You know, we're just, you know, they needed money to finish up this project, and BCPL is a little quicker at getting some of this stuff done than some of the other sources of funds. Loan number 8 is a little bit of a downtown redevelopment for St. Croix Falls. They acquired a downtown property that was in disrepair, and this is the cost of the acquisition and the repair for an eventual sale of that property. And then finally, loan number 9 is for capital budget purposes for the year, and that includes some paving, the purchase of a squad car, and some IT upgrades at the City Hall in St. Croix Falls. And that's all I have for today. Are there any questions?
Thank you, Rich. Any questions from the commissioners?
None for me.
So, looks like interest rates are going down a bit.
Yes. You know, we lowered them. The investment committee lowered interest rates a few weeks ago, and they've been relatively stable since. But they're a little bit lower than the heights that they reached over the summer.
Any other questions for Rich? See none. All those in favor of approving the loan portfolio today, say aye. Aye, Sarah.
Aye, Josh.
Hi, John.
The loans are approved. Moving on to old business, we talked, it was originally back at the end of the year, about what could potentially be some legislative changes or things to consider. And Tom put together a very helpful now about how the trust fund system really works and its accounting practices, and then ultimately four changes to consider. And so if there's no objection from the commissioners, I'd like to suspend the rules to turn it over to Tom. I think the best way to maybe go about it is see if there's any questions on just general operations, since Tom was good at capturing the different rules and regulations and operations behind all four funds. And then he goes into on the last two pages what potentially changes could be. So maybe, Tom, if we can start it that way, but I will turn it if there's no objections from the commissioners. All right, see now, let me just turn it over to you.
Thanks, Sarah. The biggest issue that I was uncomfortable with was the idea that the UW could reach into the normal school fund and, in essence, spend from a non-spendable fund. And so there are a couple of different ways of handling this. And one of the things I thought would be important to do was reach out to the state controller's office, because ultimately they're going to be a key entity in resolving this. And so I talked directly to the state controller and to her top assistant on this matter. And the controller says that she thought they'd be able to resolve the issue without legislation, in essence, creating a system under which we would send the money to the UW instead of the UW just reaching in and taking money. But to cover all the bases, I also raised the issue with our budget analyst to make sure that their office was on the same page, and they responded the same way. So all indications so far are that this may be resolved without additional legislation, but I'll be checking back with both of those entities in the next couple of weeks to ensure that progress is being made. Both of them said that if legislation would be needed on this, it would probably be best to include that as a technical piece of the upcoming budget in the next go around. So, but both of them felt that this could be resolved without legislation at this point in time.
And Tom, just to make sure I'm understanding correctly, so that would be, it could be potentially a technical update in the upcoming budget for all four accounts to make sure that they have separate earning accounts, or just the UW.
So the thing that was the most glaring issue was this idea that the UW could reach into the normal school fund. Mm-hmm. And so of what we had described and unveiled, that is the point that makes that made me the most uncomfortable. So you have four principal funds, and then you have, in essence, a custodial fund. And it's okay to operate that way. It's a little bit weird that the name of it is the Common School Income Fund. The nomenclature is wrong, but the functionality of it is okay. It's just not optimal. The only thing that was really, in Tom's opinion, wrong was this idea with the normal school fund that they were able to reach into the normal school fund to take the money, whether or not there were earnings in there for them to take. And so the idea that, in essence, that would be changed such that we would actually be sending the UW the money, similar to what we do with the Common School Fund and the other two, Agricultural College Fund and the University Fund, the normal school fund would then come in line with the other three trust funds. And that's an acceptable pathway as far as I'm concerned. So.
And could that technical, though, kind of the thought process behind that, and knowing that it's not wrong, but this is going into some just basic accounting best practices, could the same thought process be applied as a technical fix for then earning accounts for the remaining funds?
Setting up earning accounts for the remaining funds could be a technical fix as well. But as I pointed out in the memo, that also creates a lot more work on our end. And in talking with Denise, her first point is, okay, if you want to do that, but it does create a lot more transactional work on our end than to pull the pieces out of the custodial account into these other accounts, and then from those other accounts get distributed. And so I agree with you. In a best practices world, that might be the case, but a best practices world would have BCPL staffed with twice as many people as it currently has. Sorry, I couldn't resist.
I agree, Tom. I think that is, you definitely, the agency has demonstrated its ability to fund and manage itself, and it goes beyond. So, okay. So it sounds like as far as these suggested changes, the first one with the normal school fund specifically might be able to be resolved more from a kind of a technical perspective. I think then it seems like these other recommendations, so the other earning accounts, making in connecting that with potential additional revenue options if we switch from GPR to program revenue, and then also potentially with the request to keep the $50,000 that we receive from managing our submerged land leases without being basically funded to do that.
Yes.
Compensated.
Yeah. Great way of summing it up.
Okay. So with the idea then for these remaining three, it's just kind of how I am thinking about them, to be putting them as budget proposals for the upcoming budget?
I think it's got to be contingent on adding another accountant. It really, it's a situation where if you're continuing to pour more burdens onto that position without providing the resources to handle that, you're heading toward a bigger problem down the line. And so, yes, it could be handled in the budget. I'm not sure how to do it as a contingent budget proposal, let's put it that way. But that is something that I can also work with the state controller and the budget analyst on. Like I said, I have to follow up with them anyway, so I'm more than happy to do that.
I think that would be helpful because I don't know how you could do a contingency for a budget request, but there's a lot of smart people on this call, so I'm sure they could have recommendations.
So in Tom's simple world, the fact is, if that can be done without legislation, adding those separate earnings accounts, if additional resource help comes out of the budget, then you could move immediately to doing those non-legislative changes if you already had identified the path and the rationale and the support for doing it. It seemed to make a lot of sense.
No, that makes sense to me. John and Josh, I guess, any questions about the legislative changes, the approach?
I mean, for me, it's always easier if you don't have to go through legislation to get some of these things done. So that's always should be a first choice to do that. And I mean it.
Four.
Yeah, if the change doesn't need any statutory changes, then I don't see why we wouldn't try that first. If it's just kind of an accounting thing and setting up a new fund for it to come out of, I mean, I don't see there's anything to lose by asking for some of those changes to take place first.
Tom, I just have a question about the trust funds in your overview write-up on page one. Just understanding the seed structure of the fund, and I think the current just somewhat of the revenue model for it is it was seeded through federal land grants, and then in addition to fines and forfeitures, is that a percentage of fine and forfeitures? Is it all, like, what does the legislation state, and is that only seed funding, or is it supposed to be a continual kind of revenue stream in the same way that timber and now our, you know, investments have been providing some sort of, you know, distribution into the fund?
Thank you for queuing up that question. So it was only the Common School Fund that had all these other revenue sources identified in Article 10, Section 2 of the Constitution. So not only was it the land proceeds, but there were all kinds of other things in there. But the thing that has the continuing effect, the biggest continuing effect, is the provision that talks about all monies and the clear proceeds of fines and forfeitures that accrue to the state. So all monies and the clear proceeds of fines and forfeitures that accrue to the state. So there was no qualifying language on all monies. The qualifying language is on fines and forfeitures. So there was no percentage identified there. It just talked about clear proceeds. And so when things started out, the fact is there weren't necessarily any subtractions from it. If there was a $10 forfeiture, the entire $10 went into the Common School Fund. But as time went by, legislation came in and started nibbling away at things. And so by the time we hit, I believe it was 1971, the amount of that the counties were able to keep in terms of prosecuting crimes and speeding tickets had been risen to 50%. And actually, there was a court case that went all the way to the state Supreme Court, whether this was allowable, 50%. The Supreme Court said, yes, it's permissible. The Constitution talks about the clear proceeds of fines and forfeitures, and obviously it costs money to prosecute these cases, and 50% seems reasonable. And said, you can continue to do this as long as the amount that goes to the school fund is not nominal. Remember, this is 1970s thing. Well, what happened over the years is that speeding ticket went from $30 to now it's over $160, but the fine is still only $30. That $160 speeding ticket now has $130 of fees and assessments associated with it. Technically, they're not called fines. They are additional fees, assessments, and surcharges. And so, you know, on that ticket, 50% of the fine is going to the Common School Fund, but 50% of the fine is $15. Mm. You don't have to be a math major to realize that $15 is less than 10% of that speeding ticket now. And so we have a situation where the clear proceeds of the fine haven't changed in roughly 50 years, but the clear proceeds of the entire ticket have changed drastically. Does that help describe things for you?
Yeah, and I guess just knowing that and just thinking through our fiduciary responsibilities to just make sure we're doing everything we can with the revenue opportunities that we are provided, I guess I just is there something we should be thinking about, knowing that the since 1971, things have evolved and changed to a point of reevaluating and kind of what are the tools in our toolbox that allows us to do that or recalibrating?
It's a bit above my pay grade, but if I remember correctly, in the late 80s, early 90s, there was actually a Ledge Council study committee that looked at this issue. I was trying to figure out, because by then these fees and assessments and surcharges had already started. They hadn't reached their current levels, but they were already starting to build. And there was quite a bit of disagreement on the study committee as to whether what they were doing was proper. So I just remember in reading through some of those old documents that it was about as clear as mud what the recommendations were on a going forward basis.
Well, luckily we have the Attorney General on this call. Josh, I guess when you hear this and kind of this evolution, what are your thoughts on potentially ways that we should be looking or evaluating this?
I'm happy to give that some further thought. I think taking a sort of practical perspective initially, I don't know that there's likely to be much interest from the legislature in changing the way that some of those things are structured, because there are various programs that are funded with those various what was the phrase, Tom? It's not forfeitures,
the Constitution talks about the clear proceeds of fines and forfeitures, but it says nothing about fees, assessments, or surcharges.
Right. As a practical matter, I don't imagine that there's going to be a lot of interest in potential legislative change. And if the court has already addressed this issue, certainly we can think about it. But I would be surprised if that's a route the court is likely to go. But but certainly we can give a little bit of thought.
And I guess, Josh, just a question for you and for actually the lawyers on the call, and we're lucky to have three of them. This is well above my pay grade. Is it legislative is the lens to look at, or is it more legal interpretation of this that would be a better path or a different course of action to consider?
You could kind of do both, really. I mean, it's as Josh was saying, I don't know how much the legislature would want to do this, because it kind of would upend a lot of the funding structures for other things, and there'd be pushback from all sorts of different organizations. So I don't know if they'd want to take on that fight on our behalf, basically, because that's what we'd be asking them to do. Unless we manage to come up with some other funding source for all the other groups that wouldn't be getting their money in the future. But then if you go to the legal route, then you don't really have to convince all these other groups. You just have to convince the court. So, it's both ways are possible, but one way is you have to deal with less people, I guess.
Yeah.
The fact is, for practical purposes, you need both. If you think about what would happen if a lawsuit came through and challenged the status quo. For the most part, it is doubtful that the Supreme Court would make up its own allocation. It could invalidate current statutes, it could invalidate current procedures, but ultimately would not likely then take it upon itself to do a reallocation. And so ultimately, if there was successful litigation, you would need legislation, as the state treasurer pointed out, to make sure that, in essence, entities that had been relying on some of these funding sources were then funded with other funding sources.
Yeah, and I guess I'm just thinking through this as we are kind of going about a reevaluation and what do we need to be thinking about to best position the agency. And we've talked about accounting practices and things that make sense. I guess I'm just thinking through, knowing that this is something that was changed or kind of last really evaluated in 1971, does it make sense for us to also dive a little bit further into this particular kind of all monies, knowing how it has evolved with these additional services, fees? Is that something that we should consider?
So I want to sort of be clear about how I want to weigh in here, which is not as, you know, an attorney for BCPL. And if there's, you know, a need for further legal analysis, I'm happy for that to be separate. But just as a sort of practical matter and as a commissioner, you know, I mean, I will just say that there's not going to be any appetite in the courts for reconsidering this from scratch. And sort of, that's my instinct, at least, not a legal analysis, just as sort of a practical matter, because you're talking about getting into upending funding mechanisms for all sorts of municipalities. And, you know, and I haven't looked at the legal question as to whether we're only receiving a negligible amount or not. But it's hard for me to, given the case that Tom was talking about before that permitted this kind of allocation, it's hard to see how, you know, 50 some years hence, that's going to get changed. Plus, you know, usually there's sort of this concept that if you don't assert your rights, you lose them. And so, you know, for us to step in 50 years later seems like something that the courts would view with a lot of skepticism. Again, that's not considered legal analysis. That's just sort of my reaction.
It's important to point out that the Constitution refers to all monies and the clear proceeds of fines and forfeitures that accrue to the state. And so if you get that speeding ticket in Madison and it goes to a municipal court, BCPL gets none of that money into its common school fund because the fine itself accrues to the municipality. So the only pieces of these fines and forfeitures that are actually going into the common school fund are cases that are coming through the circuit courts, through the county courts. And that's why you have this split of 50-50 with the county, because the underlying fine or forfeiture is actually going to the state. So I agree with the Attorney General. There's a lot of other issues associated with it. And if it needs further review, I'm happy to play whatever role the board would ask me to do on that, because actually I've looked at this issue and torn it apart inside out over the years. Because I was curious at first, why does we get part of the tickets that go to circuit court, but not to municipal court? Well, Again, that was decided in a Supreme Court case back in, I think, 1866 or something like that, which closed the door on it. And the court at that point just pointed out, look, the fine goes to the municipality. So if it doesn't accrue to the state, how could a part of it go to the common school fund? But since 1971, when the court said, yes, you can split the money with the county 50-50, what happened since then, like I said, was this growth of these other fees, surcharges, and assessments. And so that has been a continuing change since 1971. The best place to look at some of that actually is DOT. They actually, on their website, I found a pie chart that shows who gets what on a ticket. And it was that colorful pie chart that makes jump out at you that common school fund gets less than a 10% slice.
Tom, to that end, how are those fees set? Is that based on
statute? Yep.
And so as the statutes have been amended over the years since 1971, the fraction of those fees that goes to other things has, well, the absolute dollar amount of the things goes to the other things has gone up, whereas the forfeiture piece has remained the same. Is that, am I understanding that right?
You are absolutely correct. In essence, the fine for speeding is $30. That has not changed since 1971. And so the underlying fine has remained the same. And so all these additional things were added onto it. So they really never, none of the statutes talk about fractional shares or anything like that. It is merely talks about in gross dollar amounts what is added to the underlying fine.
So, I mean, one avenue that would suggest is that, you know, if the legislature is making changes in those ticket costs, I'm not, to be clear, I'm not advocating for increasing speeding ticket fees, but if it's doing it anyway, you know, being at the table as they consider that and think about what share of that should go to the PCPL is something I think makes sense. You know, prospectively, and I don't know if those are discussions that have happened over time or not, but I'm curious if we know that.
There are two developments during my time here. One of them was the fact that there was the growth of municipal courts across the state. There were a fair number of places where a smaller municipality decided, hey, we can make some money by having our own municipal court, and so the fines will accrue to us. I don't mean to call out any particular community, but Rosendale had developed quite a reputation for funding virtually all of their operations from speeding ticket revenues. And based on that, there were quite a few other smaller municipalities that added municipal courts. And as they added municipal courts, as you can imagine, fewer tickets went through the local circuit court. As fewer tickets went through there, the amount of fines and forfeitures coming into the common school fund dropped. And as we stand here today, our fine and forfeiture revenue is roughly half of what it was when I started here. I don't think that we've got half as many people speeding or breaking the law as there were that many years ago. It's much more likely due to the proliferation of municipal courts, but I do not know of any studies that have actually confirmed the relationship between the additional municipal courts and the change in fines and forfeitures accruing to the state. The other thing was there was a time when the counties pushed for more of that underlying ticket to go to the county because of the fact that in some counties where there were now municipalities that had municipal courts, it wasn't just the common school fund that was losing a piece of the revenue. The circuit court and therefore the county was losing some revenue as well. And therefore the counties had pushed for a much greater share of that original ticket. And oh, forgive me, but my sense of time is compromised a bit. I know it was at least 10 years ago, but I don't know if it was 10 or 12 or 15. But after significant discussions, that approach ground to a halt and was, it never got to, I believe it never even got to a full vote in either house of the legislature.
Have you, Tom, had any conversations with the counties on that issue?
A couple of them. And I talked to Mark O'Connell himself. But again, like I said, this was quite a few years ago.
So, I mean, I think one of the issues with the ticket and the amount they're charging for fines and, you know, the assessments and all that is they're not really trying to raise the cost of the ticket. They're just trying to find an alternative revenue source and being able to say, we didn't raise taxes. We're just making the people who use the services pay more. So that's why the BCPL portion hasn't gone up, because they're not really trying to raise money for BCPL or for the counties. They're just trying to fund the courts without taking it from GPR. And this is their way to do it. So that's, I mean, that's kind of why they're not really, I mean, they just found a way to tack it on to something and nobody really objected too much, because nobody's going to object to somebody who's speeding and driving recklessly paying more money. So, that's why, you know, I don't think they'd be considering turning everything into part of the fine and divvying it up again, because that takes away the whole purpose of why they did it, structured it this way.
So, in kind of hearing this, just to make sure I'm capturing everything correctly, is that there's really one option, which is if or when the legislature wants to actually address what ticket costs are in statute, that's really would be our opportunity to be a voice at that table when you look at how much a ticket goes where to whom, and see how we could potentially, you know, just be a voice and maybe increasing that percentage, because it doesn't make sense to look at, is it negligible, because it's really been fees and service charges. It has not been the ticket price itself. So, like, legally, even looking at what's considered negligible or not, it wouldn't matter because of this kind of creative workaround strategy that's been deployed for a long time.
I mean, I would think so. Just if everyone's asking for a little bigger slice of it, then we can say, well, an extra $5 or something per ticket. Because otherwise, if they just increase the fees everywhere else, they might as well increase the base fee too. It's not too much more of an ask, and I don't think it would upset anybody else either. I mean, that's kind of the key. You don't want the counties and the court system also on the other side of us. So if everyone's asking for a small increase to keep up with inflation or whatever, that might work better than just trying to say, take all their money and give it to us.
And just to make sure I'm too under, because I'm not as familiar with the fines, fees, and forfeiture structure, but for this, it's not the municipality, because they've created kind of their own revenue stream through the muni clerks. These are really fines at the county and state. Those are the two government entities that are a part of this equation. It's not the municipalities, it's the counties and the state. And just to also, because again, I'm just trying to make sure I'm understanding, so there's the 72 counties, and then are there multiple agencies at the state in addition to the BCPL then?
That get a share of the ticket proceeds?
Yeah.
Yes. So let's go back to the first statement that the municipalities are not part of it. It's amazing how much nuance there is to this. If you get a ticket somewhere, oftentimes the law enforcement individual writing that ticket has a little bit of discretion as to where they're going to send this ticket. Are they going to send it to a municipal court, or are they going to send it to a circuit court? And there have been times where the tradition in a particular area may have been to send it to circuit court, and they decided, nope, from now on, we're going to send it to the municipal court. Obviously, again, above my pay grade to make that decision as to where the ticket goes.
Go on.
No. The most important thing I think that I can, the important point I can make here is what we have is a trend line that over time fines and forfeitures going, the portion of fines and forfeitures going to the common school fund has been going down. And that accelerated over the course of the last 15 years. Is it worth, taking a closer look at? Yes. There are a multitude of factors at play here and a multitude of players involved. And so it's one of these things where it's like an onion. There is layer after layer after layer after you peel it off. But that doesn't mean it's not worth looking at. I think it is important to look at it. I just don't anticipate an easy path to resolution.
Tom, I'm a little surprised. John, go ahead.
I was just going to add, so depending on where the ticket gets sent, Sarah, sometimes if it's a small municipality who has a part-time police officer, part of their, the idea is that's a revenue generating position, so they'll always be writing tickets to their local. If you get pulled over on the interstate by the state patrol, that goes to the county. Often the sheriffs will go to the county, but some of the local ones are, we need more police because they'll generate revenue and it kind of feeds into itself. So, and then you have, of course, deputies moonlighting as local police, part-time police officers, and it gets confusing, but that's kind of how it's like Tom was saying, it's really up in the air depending on who you get and who you get pulled over by.
Makes sense.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, as to the municipal court issue, I'm most surprised that the counties wouldn't be more engaged on that issue, because that's directly impacting their revenue stream, and to the extent that we're thinking about trying to change the long-term trend here, I would think that they would be a sort of logical partner to work with.
Yeah, agree, Josh. This has been a very helpful conversation. I don't know if there's any direct actions from this. I guess, Tom, if you want to see if the counties or if this is coming up anytime soon with regards to reevaluating if the legislature is going to be looking at ticket prices, but I feel like it seems from this conversation, and that's really the only option to really get into this to address the downward trend.
I will probably be seeing Mr. O'Connell in approximately 3 hours, as the county's association is having their event tonight. I won't bring it up tonight, but I'll ask Mark if he's got some time in the foreseeable future that we can talk a bit. So,
yeah, and Tom, I will say on the legal side of things, it's certainly, please feel free to reach out to folks at DOJ, and we're happy to discuss. We can always brainstorm and see if there are issues we should be thinking about here, but given how entrench this system as it seems like we should have clear eyes about the where we are on this.
Happy to do so.
If there's no more questions or comments, I think the next step with kind of addressing some of these opportunities and changes, Tom, we can put it back on you, and based on conversations with the accountant or the county's association, I think just keep us apprised, knowing that whether it's a technical update or budget, these will be things that we might need to be looking at, but understanding where we are, why we are where we are, and the opportunities that are needed for change. I think this was a really, again, great memo and a helpful conversation.
I would just want to say there's one thing we didn't talk about is the all other revenue part, and there's that the submerged land leases. I mean, if that's only $50,000, that's not really a big ask to redirect to BCPL. I mean, and they're not going to notice that out of the GPR, money. So I'm wondering if that can't be part of a request as well. It's not a huge change. And that could possibly fund all sorts of things at BCPL.
So if we go back 5 years ago, when BCPL was funded with program revenue, even though submerged land lease revenue went to the general fund, in essence, what it acted as was an offset. And so let's say that our operating expenses for the year were $1.5 million, but we had produced $50,000 in submerged land leasing revenue. The way the accounting system worked is the $50,000 was offset against the $1.5 million. And so the actual amount of trust fund revenue that was spent on agency expenses was actually $1.45 million. So in essence, we went from a situation where we weren't given the money, but we were given credit for generating the money. And I agree that we now have a situation where we are producing this stream of revenue, and even though it's not huge, there's no credit being given to the agency for that.
I felt like that might be a good first step to try to redirect some of these streams, at least get them used to the idea that these little bits can be much more useful with BCPL than just dropped in the general fund and nobody notices.
And at the risk of sounding like I'm patting myself on the back way too much, when I got here, the total amount of submerged land leasing revenue that came through our agency was a couple thousand dollars. When I say a couple thousand, I'm saying two. So it's been a substantial increase over the years. So.
Well, feel free to keep pointing that stuff out, because if you don't do it, nobody will. So. Yeah, no problem with you telling us how much you've made, so that's fine. Thanks. Keep doing it. That's my message.
And I think, John, to that point, just to kind of recap, I think part of the next step is with regard to program revenue and land lease funds to consider that as part of the budget, incorporating that into like an upcoming budget proposal.
I would think so. Yeah, I'd been asking some questions to legislators. Why is this GPR? Why isn't this program revenue? That's certainly something we should bring up, and we'll see where we get. But I thought this little piece, at least, I mean, this probably isn't there. They wouldn't put up as much of a fight. So I feel like at least that little bit would get through without.
Yeah.
Without too much conflict. It's just not worth the trouble, I think, of hour long hearing or something. So it might slip through, but that's the kind of thing that just I'm a big fan of just kind of getting little wins and then seeing what we can get.
For sure. Anything else about the memo? All right. Well, Tom, we will continue to forward to your updates and really appreciate you again taking the time to lay everything out. And I think among you've got a really good sense of where we need to go and why. So appreciate it. So that was old business. We have no new business. And then we're just moving on to routine business. And Rich, the chief investment officer's report, and you've got your quarterly investment.
I do. You know, but Sarah, I intend to keep my investment report pretty short today. I promise not to take up too much of your time. The packet today includes the regular quarterly reports, as mentioned, that are constructed for the Common School Fund and updated for today's meeting. But my focus is going to be on accomplishments that we have over the past 12 months. Our portfolio is performing as expected. Our continuing diversification is designed to stabilize returns and distributions over a variety of market conditions, and it is doing just that. The bottom line is that the value of the Common School Fund increased by about $70 million, or 5.3% last year. The projected annual income increased another $6 million over the past 12 months to nearly $70 million. The investment committee was kept busy in 2023 by further diversifying our portfolios. In the Common School Fund, we made 6 new private fund commitments totaling $135 million during the year. These new commitments included 2 direct lending funds that originate senior secured floating rate loans. Income from these funds continued to benefit from higher market interest rates, while a strong U.S. economy should reduce the potential for any loan defaults. We also made 2 commitments to infrastructure funds. These investments are expected to provide both stable income and growth over the next decade. To give you a flavor of the type of investments being made, our first infrastructure fund now has 6 investments, including a global owner and operator of wireless towers across 20 countries in Europe, Latin America, and North America. A joint venture with AT&T to establish an open access fiber network across key markets in the United States. A vertically integrated provider of waste management and recycling services to over 30,000 municipal, commercial, and industrial customers in Canada. A leading utility scale battery platform, including energy storage assets located in critical grid locations in the United States. A leading industrial gas supplier in South Korea, serving the semiconductor, steel, and chemical sectors under long-term contracts. And a joint venture with Occidental Petroleum to develop a facility to capture and permanently store over 500,000 metric tons of CO2 per year. The common elements of these diverse investments include long-term contracted revenues with the ability to enhance operations, grow revenues, and optimize the capital structure of the businesses. Staff expects another 20 to 25 investments over the next several years to be made through our existing commitments to the infrastructure asset class. Again, stable income and growth is the goal of these investments, which all provide returns with little or no correlation to our other asset classes. Finally, we also made commitments to 2 venture capital funds with general partners with which we have worked before. These early stage investments in the healthcare and business to business tech industries continue to diversify the Common School Fund portfolio. And we anticipate these investments will help drive growth in Common School Fund principal above the long-term rate of inflation. In addition to these new private fund commitments, the State Trust Fund Loan Program was also very active over the last year. Loan disbursements of $129 million in 2023 were nearly 70% higher than in 2022 and almost double total disbursements made in 2021. We're also getting much closer to shifting our public equity strategy from a basket of ETFs to a single fund managed through direct or custom indexing. This shift will simplify the ongoing management of public equities through a low-cost and flexible strategy. We've been developing this program for over a year, and look forward to making that transition. BCPL managed trust funds have a very long investment time horizon. Some may say infinite. I believe there are three takeaways from my shortened report today. First, we shall continue to diversify our investments. Second, our portfolios are performing well, including a 60% increase in the distributions made to public school libraries over the last 2 years alone. And three, we are well positioned to provide stable and increasing distributions into the foreseeable future. There will always be risks to the financial system, and there are plenty of geopolitical concerns across the globe today. Diversification is our most important tool in limiting shocks to our beneficiaries. I can't help but be reminded of the British slogan from World War II, which is a perfect reminder as a permanent trust fund manager during both quiet and stormy times. Keep calm and carry on. Thanks for your time today. Do you have any questions?
Thanks, Rich. I guess, John and Josh, any questions?
None for me.
Me either.
I appreciate the synopsis, Rich, and kind of summarizing everything, because when you think about $135 million in six investments and what those investments are doing, it's exciting to hear more. And maybe something we can do for the commissioners at an upcoming report is even highlighting a few of the venture funds that are Wisconsin-based and the interesting projects that they're supporting, because I don't think Josh and John get to hear some of that. And it's another one of the benefits, I think, of the Common School Fund and our Independent Investment Authority. So that might be something to also add, but really appreciate the report. And it was a successful 2023.
Thanks, Sarah. I like that idea quite a bit.
And I'll just say, I'd love to hear more about what we're doing, you know, investing in Wisconsin, because you know, people ask me because I'm the treasurer, so they figure I know about this stuff. So yeah, I'd love to hear some more details about that stuff when it comes to it.
Will do.
Any other questions for Rich? Moving on to Tom's report.
Since we're at 59 minutes, I will try to keep it really brief. Next week, I'll be speaking to the Wisconsin County Foresters Association, who's meeting here in Madison. If any of you are interested, that's going to be, I think, Wednesday afternoon. After that, I'll be attending the municipal finance meetings in the Dells later next week, hosted by Ehlers. It's amazing, but they tend to do a much better job of describing and promoting our trust fund loan program when I'm in attendance there, it seems. And finally, our unusual winter is having some unusual ramifications. At a certain point in time, I wasn't supposed to even speak the words climate change, but the fact is we are encountering some significant changes. Due to the warmer weather, towns up north imposed their seasonal weight limits yesterday, which effectively suspended the logging season in early February. For the last 2 years, we had approximately $1 million each year in timber revenue. This year, we're going to be lucky to bring in half that amount. So we'll keep our fingers crossed that maybe Mother Nature may reverse course. But at this point in time, it's looking like a grim season up there for logging. So it's important to keep you apprised as to what we're encountering in the field, and that's a significant change. In any event, that's it for today, unless anybody has any additional questions.
Thank you, Tom. And if there's any other news from the county forests meeting next week, please let us know. So.
Will do.
I will save my report for our next meeting, knowing that we are 1 minute over. Is there any future agenda items? Seeing none, I move to adjourn. Is there a second?
I second.
All those in favor, say aye. Aye, Sarah.
Aye, Josh.
Aye, John.
Thanks, everybody, for a great meeting, and have a good week.
Have a good week, everyone.
Take care.